animal, talking animal, talking animal.
Good morning, this is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest today is Matt Hamilton, award-winning natural history filmmaker and writer-producer of Raptors, A Fistful of Daggers, an unusual two-part edition of the PBS series Nature, premiering tonight, with the second episode debuting next Wednesday, April 17th. A globe-traversing tour of what early on are called the ultimate predators and the most successful hunters on the planet, Raptors provides a sprawling overview of these fierce, striking creatures. So along the way on this sprawling journey, in Africa we meet the African crown eagle, considered the most powerful raptor. A 10-pound bird is shown taking down a 60-pound antelope. In northern Finland, the eagles have to contend with temperatures that can drop as low as 50 below. In South Dakota, during spring, burrowing owls are the focus, while bison and coyotes make appearances, prized by the owls, it turns out, for the value of their dung. In northeast India, we see thousands of falcons circling, looking to touch down, and so on. Let's hope raptors never decide to take over the world, because the second part of this doc series examines the way some of these birds of prey contend with the harshest habitats and most dangerous adversaries and still flourish. This includes honey buzzards in the mountains of Taiwan, tangling with Asian giant hornets, the largest hornets on Earth, an attack that involves ripping into their nests, indifferent to the stings, while in the Arctic, the snowy owls not only have to merely function, but successfully hunt amidst extreme temperatures of minus 60. So there'll be plenty to discuss with filmmaker Matt Hamilton when I have that conversation in a moment here on Talking Animals on WMNF. I do have a programming note. I'll be out of town next Wednesday, and once again, we'll be fortunate enough to have Beth Capshaw hosting the show in my absence. She has lined up a notable interview discussing a pilot program called Pet Peace of Mind, which involves helping a place family animal members in a new home after losing their beloved human caregiver in hospice. That conversation and more with Bev Capshaw on Talking Animals next Wednesday, April 17th, here on WMNF. Meanwhile, coming up later in today's program, I'll play an animal song. Again, something that used to be a signature element of the show before we added a second short interview to the latter part of the program. Today, though, I'm foregoing the second interview and we'll play an animal song later. It involves a species that often gets short shrift in the animal tune department. A bit of mystery, stay tuned, as they say. Right now, we're hoping to present our talk about raptors and films about raptors with Matt Hamilton. With a reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing DJ at WMNF, or texting 813-433-0885. We'll hopefully have Matt Hamilton with us shortly here on Talking Animals. We just have a little bit of a technical snag here. He's speaking to us from the UK, so we'll hope to have him on shortly here on Talking Animals. Stay tuned. Okay. Well, Zoom isn't always the flawless enterprise that we've maybe been led to believe. So I do have Matt by phone instead of Zoom from the UK. So let's now welcome Matt Hamilton to Talking Animals on WMNF.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Thanks, Matt. Sorry about the snag here, but I'm glad we have you now.
Hey, no problem. These things happening when, you know, communicating all over the world, it's pretty standard.
Yeah, sometimes it just comes down to a good old-fashioned phone call, apparently, so that's weird. But
this is actually interesting. It feels strangely unfamiliar.
Yeah, I know, but I appreciate you rolling with this, so let's jump in. I'm sorry we missed a couple minutes trying to struggle with the Zoom, but I do really like the film. I want to say congratulations on that, and I found it just really vivid and illuminating. Beforehand, I thought I was fairly steeped in the realm of raptors, but I learned a lot here. So I want to discuss some of those things, of course, but I also have a number of questions for you. Starting with, what prompted you to make a film about raptors? Were you a raptor expert looking to share that knowledge, or were you aiming to sort of become a raptor expert and said the way to do that is to make a film about it?
Yeah, I guess that's a good question. I mean, for me personally, I've always sort of been a filmmaker first and a wildlife lover at the same time, but my skill set really is making films. So when you're making them, you sort of look for opportunities, and I felt I personally hadn't seen anything that went really in depth with raptors, and I felt like the birds that we recognize them to be, that the sort of in a film sense, there's a lot more to offer, and there's a lot more detail and a lot more character to get out of them as well. If the opportunity came up to make a series, and very thankfully everyone came on board.
Yeah. So one theme that emerges from these two films, one that premieres tonight, as I mentioned earlier in the show, and one that debuts next Wednesday, is that owing to sort of various kind of very, in some cases, very harsh habitats and or certain types of prey that they're focused on, some of these raptors face huge challenges day to day. But I couldn't help but wonder about the parallel challenge that you might have faced as a filmmaker trying to capture key footage of these birds, you know, whether that's 40, 50 degrees or more below zero temperatures or close proximity to huge, deadly hornets. So talk to me about how you approach the filmmaking, both like the preparation, probably a considerable amount of that, and the strategy, and then whatever improvising I imagine you must have had to do along the way, given the set of circumstances here.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I guess one of that side of our job is that it seems, and it obviously is, very exotic, and you go to these challenging places and you follow animals in very challenging environments, as you say. But what happens before that is a lot of, you know, very old-fashioned, very dull desk work. So you do a lot of research, you do a lot of health and safety, because you're out in places where things, fortunately, don't always go wrong if you're well prepared, but, you know, things can go wrong. And they are challenging places. So it's all about spending a lot of time researching, talking to scientists who work in the location, working with local people that often know best, not know how to deal with these places. You've got to turn up as prepared as you can be. And that's not just with your clothing and also with the equipment, but sort of mentally too, because some of these places, particularly when it gets to, you know, a certain amount of cold, it gets very, very challenging to work, and it can become, yeah, quite a struggle. But you know, thankfully for myself and most of the guys I work with, we enjoy that sort of challenge.
So it's kind of invigorating, I guess, to sort of say, okay, we're heading into 50 below temperatures next week. Let's get excited about it, and let's dive in and just enjoy the experience, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you need to go with a smile on your face. Making films is always, everything's unpredictable, right? But you can try and work out, you can make a best educated guess as how you can control those different variables. And after that, I guess, yeah, you've got to be kind of used to things being kind of difficult, things changing, not always going according to plan, but you'll be ready to adapt, and you need to do it with a smile on your face, or, a very challenging job.
Yeah, so with that in mind, can you share some instances of things kind of going sideways over the course of the filming? Like, I'm sure there must have been here and there some challenges that got even bigger than you had anticipated and prepared for. I'm sure there were some prizes that weren't in this, some cases, all that pleasant.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, funnily enough, with this film, a lot of the shoots actually went, you know, fairly according to plan. The major problem we had was it was shot during that sort of last year of COVID lockdowns, and a lot of countries were shut. So the biggest challenge we actually had initially was we lost almost a year's worth of filming time, because so many, every time you applied for a visa or went to shoot in a country, it would lock down. And of course, you're working against, you know, unpredictable animals, sort of slightly changing seasons and whether or not a bird is nesting and that sort of thing. So that was kind of our biggest challenge. But the most dramatic thing that I guess happened was, it was a shoot I wasn't actually on, but it was in Taiwan, where the team went out and everything was sort of all right when they were setting up. And then I get a call one afternoon to say, oh, there's a massive cyclone coming through tomorrow, so we're not going to film. The next few days was just torrential rain, and they sent me these pictures of, you know, sort of like waist-high flooding around the area we're supposed to film. So they had to wait out there a little while to get back filming. And once we were settled in, we were there to film Oriental Honey Buzzers, which are the birds that attack the hornet nest.
Yeah.
Once we were settled in, I get called the next evening to say there's been a huge earthquake. And we'd all been in the same area?
Where the birds were. The earthquake was in the same area where the cyclone had been?
There was a cyclone, flooding, and an earthquake. No one was hurt, thankfully, but quite, you know, a proper, you know, they felt it. They had to evacuate the buildings and all that sort of thing.
Sounds like issues of a biblical proportion here in that area. Jeez.
Absolutely. So that was probably the sort of the hairiest it got.
Yeah.
In the trip.
Wow. And so to yield the two films that we're discussing, again, one that premieres tonight on PBS Nature, and then the next one debuts next Wednesday the 17th on PBS Nature as well, of course. How long a shooting period does that encompass to get all the shooting, especially with various weather delays and acts of God and other things factored in?
So it takes typically a film. I can tell you about this film. We had about a year and a half, almost 2 years, to film everything from when we started.
Yeah.
And in terms of pure shooting days on the ground, we shot something like 220, 230 days worth. So that sounds like a lot, but that's it's not too tight, but that's fairly tight. That's fairly. With that, you've got to be quite disciplined. You know, you're getting sort of a week to 10 days for some sequences of the birds, and sometimes maybe 2 or 3 weeks. And we had a few longer trips in there as well, things like the African crowned eagles. That's quite detailed and took a lot of work to do. So
yeah.
There was a team based in South Africa there for 12 weeks on that one, and I was out and back a couple of times. And so you sort of pace the shoot slightly differently, but generally speaking, yeah, a film like this is about 120 days per film. But yeah, we had about 240 days in total, I think.
Okay, that raises another question too. But let me let folks know who might just only be tuning in recently that this is Talking Animals on WNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. If you did just tune in, my guest is Matt Hamilton, award-winning natural history filmmaker and writer-director of Raptors, A Fistful of Daggers, an unusual two-part edition of the PBS series Nature, premiering tonight, with the follow-up second episode debuting next Wednesday, April 17th. If you have a question about Raptors for Matt or would like to offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663, email dj at wmnf.org, or text 813-433-0885. So it's mentioned, I think, at least once in each of the two films that there are like some 500 species of raptors. So as you're talking about some of the harrowing things that needed to go on and spending an extended time, you know, in some cases getting some of the footage, how did you select which ones to include? Like, what was the criteria amongst those 500 to say, okay, well, here's the ones that we are going to focus on in our films?
That's a great question. Initially when you sort of form an idea for a film and begin to write it up and write your first sort of wish lists and draft scripts, that's something that you know, I really try and put a lot of time into. And But for me, the criteria is to quite honestly work out how best the film is going to flow. So in our first episode, there's this question of what is a bird of prey? And to structure that, the first one is we meet the biggest raptor or one of the biggest and most powerful raptors, and then we meet the smallest raptor. Then we see, you know, what the challenges are for a raptor sort of growing up and nesting. And in the end, we look at the senses that separate raptors. So once you've sort of plotted out your narrative like that, you start to say, right, which raptor can represent this point that I wish to demonstrate? And that then gets quite complex because that's done a lot of phone calls to make sure, you know, that particular raptor, say, for example, you want to do a piece on hearing, and you think, right, what's the best raptor to represent this? And naturally, to me, that's a great grey owl. But then you need to find out, can we do a great grey owl sequence? Like, hey, are we going to be able to get there? How predictable is it? How many days is that going to take? And so it sort of becomes increasingly complex. But, as I said, what I try to do is form that narrative first and then try and fit the species that best represent it afterwards. And the other thing is just to make sure you've got that diversity. I think with raptors, you don't just want to do, and then hope this comes off in the film, you don't want to just say, oh, here's a bird of prey. What does it do? It hunts this animal, and just have sort of hunt scene after hunt scene after hunt scene. Yeah. What I try to do is represent different aspects of their personalities and characters and different habitats.
Yeah, well, that I think you definitely succeeded there because, as I said, I came into it thinking I knew at least a fair amount about raptors, and I was sort of blown away by all the species and maybe some of the habitats and, again, some of the hunting scenes, which aren't in some cases for the faint of heart, but it was illuminating in those ways for sure, because it's like, wow, there are a lot more raptors and a lot more across a lot more habitats than I ever would have realized before this film or these films.
Yeah, absolutely, and it's sort of, you know, hopefully to show how successful these raptors are, that these top avian predators. Getting that diversity and getting that big worldwide deal with all the different habitats and all the different behaviours is absolutely essential. So that was sort of the biggest challenge, really, when you know, writing up the film and thinking about it and putting it together, was just making sure you had that diversity that keeps it new and keeps it interesting and keeps everyone learning and experiencing these birds.
Yeah, and here's something I thought about a little bit over the course of watching both films. I guess I am curious if, as a natural history filmmaker who specializes obviously in capturing wildlife, if your work is influenced by the, general feelings about a species you're profiling. In other words, do you approach a film about, let's say, a lion or elephant, like a, you know, an animal that's, I think, by most accounts, decidedly charismatic, differently from a film about, say, in this case, raptors, which many would say are probably not particularly charismatic. Does that shape at all how you present the material or do the filming or end up with any kind?
Yeah, absolutely, and that's really interesting, really well perceived on your part. I think definitely. I think there are certain animals. Let's say like a gorilla is going to hold your attention. A shot of them, they're sort of telling their own story to you. I think among birds, you know, maybe sort of, we always joke that owls and penguins are kind of honorary mammals. They have that charisma that just works and holds the camera. But of course, there are many, many animals that don't. And so it does, that totally, it changes the way that you go about shooting. It changes the way that you set up each scene. I think when you look at it, you can take, my point of view is you can take any species. It could be the most seemingly mundane species, but as filmmakers, our job is to reveal what it is that's so fascinating about them. And everything has something that's really interesting, really quirky about it. And the big challenge is just how you tell that, just to keep people interested and bring that kind of wow moment that you get with natural history. But that is, it is a big challenge. And you absolutely just try and approach it differently with each species.
So I guess in that case, then, do you make adjustments or allowances in one case versus another? So, because obviously you want to engage the audience, but like you say, it's not inherently as maybe gripping as footage of a gorilla, let's say. So do you have to sort of strategically say, let me present this way, because it's not a gorilla, it's a raptor tearing into its prey. And as you said, you can't just have footage after footage of the same kind of thing, although, again, across all these raptors, there's quite a bit of different styles of prey and habitats that are reflected. But do you have to sort of tweak what you're doing to also further, you know, make it say, hey, well, I still want this to be an engaging piece of film no matter what the focus is on screen?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, I hope if you watch, say, tonight's episode, so much of that comes down to the pacing of it. Like the way it's shot as well, but I think the most obvious thing to describe would be how you pace it. So there are certain animals. If you take that African crowned eagle that we meet in the rainforest at the beginning, that has this just otherworldly, like incredible feel to it. So there's moments there where it holds the image, and that affects how quickly you edit the shot as well. So sometimes it can be a little bit slower before each cut. So each shot might last maybe 7 to 10 seconds or maybe a bit less. And then when you go from that into, say, the black-eyed falconet, which is the smallest raptor in the world, it's a good opportunity to sort of meet the character, which is this small, fast-moving bird. So there you're looking at editing it like much quicker. So you need sort of many more shots to make those sequences work. Also, when you bring the music in, you can bring in music sometimes to match that character. So say you might make with that smaller bird, it might be more upbeat, more joyous, so it matches the character. But at times you can also take the music sort of contrary to what you think. In that that Seriema at the end, where it fights the snake, is just totally not what you're expecting, I think. So when we come into that sequence, the music has this wonderful sort of light, dancey feel to it. And then it twists because you just do not expect what's going to happen. And it becomes much more sort of sinister. You think, wow, like this bird really, really is a lethal predator. And then I like the way the music twists back at the end of that scene as well. So all those different elements that you use in filmmaking kind of come in to keep the film moving on and try and keep the interest moving on.
So I'd be curious, in light of all those choices and just the exposure to obviously a huge array of raptors, how did you feel just personally about raptors when you started the process initially, you know, and then what changed, if anything, over the course of making the film and capturing some of those raptors on film, how you felt about either raptors generally or specific raptors in particular?
Yes, so funnily enough, this film, particularly in the second episode, the opening sequence with the snowy owl, that's actually, there's a strong emotional connection for me because that's where my career began. So the first opportunity I ever had on a natural history film was filming snowy owls.
Oh, wow.
And that was, gosh, about 12 or 15 years ago. And when you in this industry you sort of, you know, you need to have work, you need to make films, so you pitch the shows that you would like to do, but sometimes you work on a show that maybe you didn't set up, but the opportunity comes along and off you go and do it, so you end up sort of like going into different corners. So I spent a long time filming orangutans, for example, which are also fantastic. So for me, this was really nice to come back to raptors and revisit a few things that I'd always hope to do and often thought about. And I think for me, like during, so it's, I mean, I had this inherent interest in birds of prey anyway. But just this experience, when you make a film like this, you spend so much time talking with experts and reading papers and then spending time with the birds where you're filming. And even in the edit as well, you spend a lot of time just looking at shots of them. And it just makes you realize how incredible and how fantastic and diverse these birds are. I think, and I hope it comes across, there's some real surprises in there. I mean, there were some birds that I wasn't aware of before we started this film, but in sort of reading up and speaking to people, came across a few quite special raptors that I wasn't so familiar with.
Cool. Can you name one or two of those that you were newly introduced to just in the course of working on this film?
Absolutely, yes. And so, I mean, if I look at the ones, now I've got notable sequences, the African harrier hawk, or the gymnogene, that's in the second episode.
Yeah.
I hadn't heard of them before we started, before I started planning this film. And they are just incredible birds. They've got double-jointed legs. So their legs bend backwards and forwards, which means they can reach into tree holes. And they poke their head in and look around, and they stick their legs in and feel about. So it means they can, especially during nesting season, where you get tree hole nesting birds, they are, I mean, an absolute top predator of them. They're probably one of the most feared raptors of all, I'd say. But yeah, I wasn't familiar with them, especially that double-jointed leg, which is just terrifying.
Yeah.
other thing would be the Florida snail kite as well, with this extraordinary hooked beak that they have. And that's a fascinating story in itself.
Yeah, I was going to get into that a bit later when we talked a little bit more specifically about the second episode, but we're already into it now. And of course, you know, you're talking to me in Florida, so that's something of a local story. So the Florida snail kite, diet is or was chiefly aquatic snails. And then can you talk a little bit about kind of what the story is? Because it sort of involves, sort of change or evolution in a sense, and almost in a vaguely science fiction kind of way, in a sense.
It's absolutely extraordinary. So the Florida snail kite is obviously unique to Florida. Snail kites are found through Central America into Northern South America, living in wetlands, and yes, they feed on these aquatic snails. The Florida snail kite fed on the island apple snail, it's called. But back in the early 2000s, an invasive snail moved in. It's originally from, I believe it's from Puerto Rico. It's called the island apple snail, and it grows to about five times bigger than the native snails that the Florida snail kites were used to eating. And so what happened was, over about 10 years, the snail kite population just dwindled. And there was, people thought that could well be it for the species in Florida. It was a little more than a decade later, the numbers had bounced back. All of a sudden, they started bouncing back, and they came up to about 2,000 birds, which was sort of triple what was left a few years before that. And no one could really believe it. So the scientists started looking at the data that they had. They go out and they check nests and they measure chick growth and things like that. And what they found was that in 10 years, the Florida snail kite's beaks had grown to between 8 and up to 12% bigger. And their body size had grown bigger too, like in response to this new snail, which is just...
Isn't that remarkable?
Yeah, extraordinary. So you're seeing that change in it's a little under two snail kite generations.
Yeah.
Which is just absolutely incredible. And I think, globally, in terms of conservation value, no one before that thought that a top predator could adapt to such a change in its prey in that kind of way. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, well, it is an unbelievable sort of evolution and adaptation. And again, it's like I say, it's almost... this vaguely sci-fi-ish in a way, because for that to happen to that, to change the size relatively that quickly, I mean, you feel like, okay, this can't be real, but it obviously is. But it was certainly striking, and thank God.
Thank goodness, for now they're doing great. There's always, for any raptor, for any animal, there's always different threats that they're facing, in particular in these years. But for now, it seems like that they're doing great. And that response to this invasive snail, where people thought that was it for them, is, just so incredible.
Yeah, that's the thing, because you think, sometimes animals obviously necessarily adapt to a certain circumstance or habitat change or, whatever. But for something to be that dramatic, you just think, how is that even possible? I mean, you just think, just when you think animals can't surprise you more, this happens.
That's it. And it's so, hopefully for the future of raptors, they're such incredible and hardy and, just these amazing survivors that that's still absolutely incredible and amazing and surprising, but it gives you a bit more hope. It kind of shows that if the space is there, that they can adapt to these changes.
Yeah. Yeah, really unusual set of circumstances, and the outcome is even more unusual, obviously. This is Talking Animals on WNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest is Matt Hamilton, writer-director of Raptors, A Fistful of Daggers, an unusual double edition of the PBS series Nature. The first episode premieres tonight on Nature, and the second episode, which we're starting to talk a little bit more about, debuts next Wednesday, April 17th. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have any questions or comments about raptors or about the films, 813-239-9663. You can email us at dj@wmnf.org. You can text 813-433-0885. So initially we were talking really more about the first episode that does premiere tonight. But the next one, which is for next Wednesday, the 17th, part two essentially, is entitled Extreme Lives. And Well, we obviously just talked about the, snow kites, but can you talk a little bit more about, just generally about the film, about what sort of different territory you're seeking to explore in it, having set up what you did in episode one?
Absolutely, yeah, yeah. So in episode one, we look at this question of what exactly is a bird of prey, and we introduce all these different characters. In episode two, it's the focus is on the most extreme habitats, the most extreme behaviors. So from, you know, the cold, frozen north to taking on things like oriental honey buzzards in Taiwan to, ultra-adapted sectary birds, for example, that they can fly but spend most of their time walking. They can walk 20 miles a day. All the way to striated caracara who live on these remote islands and survive because of their intelligence. So what it is looking at the most extreme examples of what makes birds of prey so successful.
Yeah, and as I said in the introduction, I'm not sure you're able to listen at that point, but I was saying something about, let's hope that raptors never decide to take over the world, because especially in the second part of the series, you really see the incredible way they contend with what are in some cases just super harsh habitats and obviously some super dangerous adversaries as prey, and they flourish. And you just think, boy, if they decided to turn their abilities to the evil of the world, we'd all be sunk. But kidding aside, I mean, it's remarkable what some of these, and again, that's where I think a lot of people who think they know a fair amount about raptors are going to find there's a whole different world of raptors that they probably haven't been exposed to before these films. Let's talk a little bit more. You mentioned, made a passing reference or two to the secretary bird, but I mean, that's a tall drink of water, first of all. But I wouldn't want to be a snake in the secretary bird's proximity. Can you talk a little bit about the secretary bird more, just because they're unusual in, I think, multiple ways?
Absolutely, yeah, yeah. So the secretary bird, they live on the African savannas. They're the height of about a seven-year-old child, and they move around on foot. So that, yeah, they can walk about 20 miles a day in these open habitats, and they have these really long legs. That basically the grass that they walk over, those legs sort of meet about the top of the grass, which means when they're scanning the ground below, they're at the perfect height to look for anything they can spot, really. So they do eat a lot of insects. There's a lot of insect-eating raptors, but of course, secretary birds can take on snakes, reptiles, and rodents too.
But also, if I'm not mistaken, unless I'm hopefully not confusing this with one of the other raptors, don't the secretary birds like grab a snake or whatever they're grabbing in their talons, which of course they all have talons, it's one of the kind of characteristics across raptors, and basically like just slam. Isn't that where the
ones? That's the Sariema from the first episode.
Very similar looking bird.
But yes, it's a Sariema that has the unique way of hunting, where they pick things up, and we've got them picking up a snake, and they slam it onto the ground. So yeah. The secretary bird is the one that kicks things to death. So we do have a secretary bird kicking a scrub hare.
Yeah, I saw so many dark behaviors. I'm starting to get them blurry, I guess, a little bit, and speaking of dark, there are more than a few sections of just really striking footage in both installments, really, though part two inherently, I think, features more drastic scenery, just given, the nature of it. But I remain haunted by the segment set in the mountains of Taiwan. We've touched on this sort of in passing along the way, but featuring the honey buzzards and their voracious appetite for Asian giant hornets. Like I say, I'm still haunted by some of that. That just seems like bonkers, really, that they're going after these horrible, huge, vicious hornets, and that's their prey.
Yeah, for me, that's one of my favorite behaviors, and it's just so extraordinary. So what happens, and when you go to film there in Taiwan, you want to time it. It stops in autumn, basically, where the hornet nests are at their biggest. Now these are Asian hornets. So they're the size of your thumb, and they can kill a person with a couple of stings. And the honey buzzers, once the nest gets to a decent enough size, they gather around, and they gather around. There'll be several of them as well. So it's sort of a cooperative attack. And what happens is after we were there for a few weeks with those birds, but they it takes them a little while to sort of size up the nest, and then one of them will move in. And that first time it moves in, it's kind of a smash and grab. So what it's doing is going in and just trying to punch a hole in the side of the nest. And once that's started, it's then pretty quick. It's a few days, basically, between that initial hit. And then more honeybugs will just start coming in and hitting it. And this war of attrition begins, where eventually the hornets sort of give up. And once the honeybuzzards have smashed the nest up a bit, a few bits have dropped off, of course, as well. They're then left to feed on the larvae inside, which is what they're after. But it is just the most extraordinary scene, I think. And the way these honeybuzzards do it is even more extraordinary. So it's fairly recent, the research on them, that someone was looking into how they can do this. And they basically got, there's a few different techniques that the honeybuzzards have to protect themselves. One is that they have these special barbs on their feathers that really like close, they have these really tiny feathers close to their body. That stack together a bit like sort of chainmail body armor.
Yeah.
So the sting can't get through it. They then also have this this strange kind of unique substance. It's a sort of filament-based substance that covers their feathers, and it's thought, no one's proved it yet, but they've had a sort of, they started to look into it. They think that acts almost as an insect repellent. So fewer hornets. They also take on honeybees as well. So fewer hornets, fewer bees.
And doesn't
land on their body during these attacks.
Yeah, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt there, Matt. But doesn't something along the line too of like something like kick in? It almost looks mechanized, except it's a bird for their eyes that protects their eyes.
Yes, they have this membrane they can cover their eyes with, so that stops any stinging attack.
Yeah,
on the eye as well, which is kind of the only vulnerable part. And interestingly, that substance that they think works as a repellent, it's super concentrated around their eye as well. So the one vulnerable part of the bird is seemingly one of the most protected.
Yeah, no, it's they're so remarkable. And again, some of the sort of sub themes of what we've been talking about, some of those particular raptors, is the incredible adaptations. I mean, like, you know, I don't know what the honey buzzards were like X amount of generations ago, but I would think some of this evolved so that they could be better protected against what seems like would otherwise be vicious attacks by these Asian giant hornets. I mean, I can't...
Yeah, absolutely. It just looks like a completely mad mission going on and something you never touch.
It does seem like sort of kamikaze and like almost like self-destructive, like, Jesus, what? How much do you want these hornets that you're willing to sort of bust into their hives?
Yeah.
And
that's the amazing thing, because, like, you know, those buzzards, they've got sharp talons. They've got the ability to catch small reptiles, small rodents as well. But they obviously, they want those hornet larvae because it's quite an extraordinary step to take.
Incredible.
But it kind of shows what we hope it demonstrates, just how well raptors are able to adapt to different types of prey and different habitats.
Yeah. Well, we're sort of nearing the end of our time, Matt, but I'm just curious, because you knew a lot about the raptors and you're familiar with most, but you've said at least one or two you weren't familiar with before. So by the time you're done, is there, I don't know if favorite is quite the right word, because it seems weird to have a favorite raptor, but is there one that kind of just you were most struck by or just stuck with you after all the filming was done and you just thought, I keep finding myself thinking about this particular raptor for this reason or that reason?
Oh, absolutely. And here's the funny thing. Whenever you make a film, you become an expert at making that film, only you never get a chance to make it again because you've just done it.
Right.
So you're always left thinking, oh, I'd love to get that behavior. I'd love to do that differently. But that's kind of, you know, you learn to live with that when you do this job. I mean, there are a number that I absolutely love. I mean, I think the Amur Falcons are incredible in episode one. I love Great Grey Owls that are in episode one as well. But for me, the one that I think about, if someone asks that question about a favorite, it's the striated caracara in the Falkland Islands, because they are just so, so different and for so many reasons. I think when a lot of bird filming like this, you're in a hide and you're using our big telephoto lens that we use. So it's quite, you know, you stay still, you spend a lot of time waiting and you take your moments when they happen. But with the caracara, they are not afraid of you at all. In fact, I mean, they were there. They were standing on my head. Like, one was standing on my shoulder at one point when I was filming. So it's a totally different filming experience because you get to do a bit of exercise. You get to walk around with them, and you can see. And they're always doing something different. So I live on the remote Falkland Islands, and they're sort of cast away there. And what happens there is that for about 6 months of the year, you have all these breeding seabirds. So there are carcasses around, there are young penguins and things that the adults can catch and feed their chicks. But as the chicks fledge, this time very quickly comes where the food just starts to run out, because you have 6 months where there aren't breeding seabirds there, and any birds that are there are fairly healthy. And so they need to survive. And only a quarter of each year's chicks are thought to get through the winter. And now the way that they do this is that they rely on intelligence, which makes them really stand out amongst birds of prey. And some of that intelligence comes from their social interactions. So the juveniles, once they've fledged, they gang up. And the point of ganging up and working together is that they can overwhelm adult pairs of caracaras. So say a carcass washes up one day, there'll be a pair of adults that own that particular territory because it's only small islands. But the juveniles can walk in as a gang. And by working as a gang, they can kind of fight back and drive the adults away, and they all get to feed. But I think the best thing that I found when I was swimming with them was we spent a bit of time down on the beach with these elephant seals.
And when the
caracaras came along, and they're super inquisitive as well. And I'm filming the elephant seal, and I look over, and there's a caracara just walking right up to these, you know, there's several tons, these elephant seals, they're absolutely enormous. And the caracara is just looking in its face, it walks up and picks some snot from its nose. And it's absolutely disgusting, but it was there for a few hours. And it came back the next day as well, and it's, you know, it's a horrible, it's a sort of funny thing to see, but it just shows how smart and inquisitive they are.
And brave, I mean, because that's you would think that's high risk to get that big of an animal, you know, that kind of proximity, much less, you know, maybe irritate that big of an animal.
Oh, absolutely. And the elephant seals are going at them some. You know, want to walk past and they'll swing their head or swing their tail at it, because the caracara as well will eat the molting skin. So the elephant seals haul out for about 3 weeks in autumn to molt their old skin, and the caracaras will come and tear it off, which seems to aggravate the seals. And they'll also, if there are any old wounds or anything, they'll have a really good pick at that. And so it's quite, I think they're pretty annoying.
Yeah.
they're brave too. And just spending time watching them is just fascinating. It's something different every day with them.
Well, I would say fascinating applies to both films. So we have kind of reached the end of our time, Matt. But we've been speaking with Matt Hamilton, who is the writer-director of Raptors, A Fistful of Daggers. Again, it's a two-part edition of the PBS series Nature. First part premieres tonight, and the second part follows up next Wednesday, the 17th, again on the PBS series Nature. So, Matt, thank you so much for joining us on Talking Animals, and sorry for the rough start there with our Zoom snag, but we got going after that, and I really appreciate speaking with you, and I really enjoyed
it. Hey, no problem. Thank you so much. I'm supposed to say it's been a hoot, and an absolute pleasure speaking to you. Thank you very much, Duncan.
All right. Well, anytime I can be a hoot for anybody, I'm that's a good day, so that's awesome. So thanks very much, Matt. We'll talk to you next time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Bye. Okay, right now we're going to step into the Comedy Corner with a raptor-relevant bit of stand-up. This is Matt Bronger with a piece called Owls in today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals on WMNF.
Anyway, Harry Potter. I like them. I like the books. I like the movies. But I think they send the wrong message to our kids. And that's that it's okay to own an owl for a pet. No. Okay? I'm from Oregon, I know. Owls are made of claws, feathers, and hatred. That's it. Like, owls don't give a crap. You ever look at an owl, the rage and hatred in his eyes? Up in a tree, like, who? Who? Who's next to die? It's you, mouse! Owl! And I'm back, hating everything that lives. But the kids want owls. Look, I know a lot of you guys are like, nuts to you, I'm getting an owl. Don't do it, okay? Because a friend of mine was driving once after a storm, and he found a baby owl that fell out of a tree, right? A baby owl. Can you imagine anything cuter than a baby owl? Like, don't hurt your brain. It's impossible, right? Not even a kitten with an eye patch is cuter than a baby owl. And that's cute. A little pirate kitten, right? So my friend my friend gets this, gets it home, and he calls the Humane Society. He's like, hey, I found a baby owl. How do I raise it? And the guy's like, let it go, dummy. The Humane Society called him a dummy. Like, their name means the Be Nice Society. You know they weren't messing around, you know? But they told him this. They said, an owl that you raise in captivity will never stop trying to attack you. Again, it knows it's you. It knows who you are. Imagine having this animal in your house growing strong off its hatred of you. Just sitting in a cage doing owl prison exercises, getting ready. Like waiting for that day he makes his Hannibal Lecter-like escape wearing another owl's face. Surprise! I'm not the good owl. Death! Like you come home, he's taunting you. You've had a hard day at work coming home and you see this. Hey, how's it going, buddy? Yeah, it's me, your owl. Didn't get that promotion, huh? That sucks. Know what else sucks? I'm gonna kill you when I get out. Oh, you're gonna hide from me? You can never hide. My head goes all the way around. You're dead. All right, stay loose. Prepare for war. Stay loose. Thank you, guys.
That was Matt Bronger in today's Comedy Corner with a piece called Owls, taken from his first appearance on Letterman. Now we're going to move into a couple of things coming up. First, I want to let you know that WNF is Slice of Life, the wonderful new show hosted by Randy Zimmerman and occasionally others. After that, we shift back to music programming with Jim Bannon holding forth from 1 to 3, followed by Nancy C hosting the Wednesday Traffic Jam from 3 to 6 p.m., at which point our terrific Wednesday night block of Latin music kicks in. That's all coming up here on 88.5 FM WMNF. So we're going to move into Name That Animal Tune. And as a prize for Name That Animal, I'm going to be offering something fabulous from the Talking Animals Vault. The first person who calls 813-239-9663 and correctly identifies this animal song, Name That Animal Tune, on Talking Animals and WMNF. If you can name that animal tune, we'll probably take your guests off the air because we have just about reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa. Again, I'll be away next Wednesday, April 17th, but Bev Capshaw will be hosting the show in my absence, featuring an important interview about a significant new program that helps cats and dogs who've lost their humans through in hospice care. So be sure not to miss that. I'll be back following Wednesday, the 24th. You can always go to talkinganimals.net for archives of every show we've ever done, and Apple Podcasts are available too, as well as other podcast platforms. There are also links to our social media pages and more. That's all at talkinganimals.net. I'm Duncan Schuss. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. This is Talking Animals on WMNF, Tampa, Brandon, Clearwater, Largo, Weekiwachi, and beyond. See you in 2 weeks here on Talking Animals. Bev Capshaw here next week. And stay tuned right now for coming up after NPR News, A Slice of Life with Randy Zimmerman. See you then. Thank you.